From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik. Today on Transition Lab, we have Anita McBride. She's held a number of very important positions in the White House and various Republican administrations, but for today's purposes, she was Laura Bush's chief of staff, and we're going to talk about the role of first ladies and the transition issues related to first ladies. So welcome to the podcast, and thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Why don't we start with, what was your first job in Washington?
Well, like a lot of young people that come to Washington, I worked on a campaign, and my first campaign was 1980 in Connecticut on the Reagan for President campaign. I was a campaign volunteer as a senior in college. And then he won and I moved here I had to finish my education, though. I didn't have enough credits to graduate, went to AU and continued to American University and then continued to
volunteer. So you dropped out of school and then moved.
I didn't drop out of school. I took my final semester as a transfer student here in Washington at American University.
In 1992, I was in law school and I joined the Clinton campaign, and my mom would say I dropped out of school. I did finish up.
You did finish up. That's good.
So you held a number of senior positions. How did you actually move to serve as Laura Bush's chief of staff?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think you, having worked in government and in politics before, you know how these things happen. I mean, you build a set of skills over a period of time. And in my case, you know, having worked the Reagan and Bush administration, that's a period of 12 years. And you build not only skills and different opportunities, but you build a reputation and a network. And by the time 2000 rolled around, and we all know about that election, it was unclear who the winner was going to be for 6 weeks, and which made it a very difficult transition. But Governor-elect George Bush's office people that I knew who were working there had called me here in Washington and said, we could use your help. We're putting together sort of a pre-transition transition. Knowing my background in personnel and operations, I said, of course, I'll help you. And I did. And I intended to go back into the White House for about 4 months, train a new director of White House personnel. I didn't intend to stay on the job because at that point I had two children, babies. And 4 months turned into working 8 years in the administration in various positions, including at the State Department.
So you've been involved in a number of transitions. We've talked with folks like Josh Bolton about the transition in of President Bush, the transition out of President Bush. What are the unique issues related to a transition in for a first lady?
Well, transition in for first lady obviously does not carry with it the same expansive requirements as it does for the president's taking over the entire federal government. I mean, the largest business enterprise in the world, really. The spouse of the president, of course, is conscious about the move in to the White House, establishing an office of their own, which is, you know, a small number of staff, and it varies for different first ladies. But one of the components that every spouse of the president is concerned about is making this new home comfortable for them and a sanctuary for the president, undoubtedly knowing that they're going to need that. So it's two-part in some way. It's establishing an office, finding some people to support you in the work that you want to do, but also working with the resident staff, which is a team of 90 people that are there for you for the next 4 or 8 years to take care of your needs of making this a family home.
So the president-elect has a huge operation, a huge apparatus supported by federal law to transition into government. The first lady, does she have any support?
Well, let me explain it this way. I think that it's evolved over time where first ladies are not left on their own, or the spouse of the president is not left by themselves totally to transition in. Because remember, too, increasingly, we're used to seeing a presidential spouse be engaged in the campaign as well. They're knowledgeable about the people that are around the president. Their value added is recognized. It's important. And most presidents and presidential candidates want to make sure their spouse is taken care of as well. So although it's not codified in law, there is support around a presidential spouse to make sure that they're ready to move in.
And what are the typical ways that a first lady approaches recruiting a staff? How many staff do they have? And how do they figure out what issues they want to focus on?
Well, the number varies on how many staff that they want to have. At the beginning of an administration coming in a transition, there are people who are running the transition that are determining what the staff levels are going to be office by office. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit of a negotiation. And there will be conversations with the president-elect's spouse on what their intentions are for their office. You saw with Mrs. Trump, she waited before she even came down here. She took time before she named a staff, and she's kept it quite small. That suits her needs. So the point being that there's a discussion that goes on between the president's transition team, the president's spouse, and then also dictated somewhat by what the president's spouse or the first lady's interests are and what they think they would like to work on.
So how many people did Laura Bush have on her staff?
When she first came on board, and remember in 2000, 2001 for that transition, I was the acting director of personnel. Mm-hmm. So I worked very closely in helping to bring on her staff as well as all the president's staff. She had about 15 people. It was an average size staff. I mean, and some of that includes the social office, which is four people. I mean, you want that operation functioning first because you're really starting out doing events right away, even with Inauguration Day. And then a press secretary is important, a projects director, someone to manage your schedule, do your advance. For her, that was the same person. It was a combination.
You said it's a negotiation. I've been part of these negotiations. Who would actually negotiate against a first lady, and what would the chance that person would think they could win the negotiation?
I know, it's a really, really good question, but you'd be surprised or maybe not so surprised that there are people who and I have worked on a number of transitions, and you know, there can be an attempt to manage a first lady's office, and the reality is that should be the first lady's decision with the support of the president-elect.
Seems like a losing battle for someone to fight that battle. So Mrs. Bush wrote a book, which I read, and it's really well done. One of the things that she writes about is that when she met with Hillary Clinton, when Hillary Clinton was leaving the White House as First Lady, Hillary Clinton said she wished she never had an office in the West Wing. She was the first and only First Lady to have an office in the West Wing. Mm-hmm. Did Mrs. Bush ever consider that?
No, Mrs. Bush never considered that. And actually, you know, her tour of the White House, her traditional tour of the White House by the outgoing First Lady and incoming First Lady, it happened quite late in the process, not until December of 2000. And Mrs. Clinton was very gracious and took Laura Bush around, showed her the upstairs. And let's back up a little bit. Laura Bush was probably the most prepared person to go into this position, given that she had seen her mother-in-law hold this position, had quite a bit of exposure to the White House. But even with that, nothing completely prepares you for it. And you appreciate hearing the input from those who have walked in the job, particularly your most immediate predecessor. And Mrs. Clinton was very honest with her. She showed her a couple of things that I would like to share with your listeners, too. And Mrs. Clinton took Mrs. Bush into the dressing room off the bedroom of the first couple. And she stood by a window that overlooks the Rose Garden and over into the Oval Office. And Mrs. Clinton said to Mrs. Bush, you know, your mother-in-law brought me to this very same window and told me I could look out here and look into the Oval Office and could see my husband. Mm. And she said, so I'm showing you that too. And Laura Bush did the same for Michelle Obama as well. But in their conversation, in the Laura Bush-Hillary Clinton conversation, Mrs. Clinton was honest with her. And she said, you know, I wanted an office in the West Wing. I was being given the responsibility for health care and felt it was important to be there amongst the president's policy advisors. But after the health care debacle, if you will, she said, I rarely used it again.
One of the things, you mentioned the press secretary being an important position for the first lady. One of the things is that the media scrutiny of first ladies is intense. And a lot of it, frankly, is old-fashioned. How do they look? How do they dress? How did you deal with that, and will that change? Isn't that just old-fashioned stereotyping?
It's such a great question. It's one that actually throughout our entire history as a country, it's never changed. Mm-hmm. I mean, you even read history books, you read memoirs of other first ladies. So even though we don't have a lot of Martha Washington's writings, we do know she had said she felt the pressure to be her hair and her clothes to be washed and dressed and set every single day as she was holding these salons to meet the citizens of this new republic. So from day one, the spouse of the president has, the first ladies have felt this pressure on how they look and the scrutiny over that. Mrs. Lincoln, we know she was taken to task for how much money she spent mm-hmm. on her clothing. It's tiresome, of course. I mean, nobody wants to be identified in a very one-dimensional mm-hmm. way, and certainly around clothing. But there are first ladies in our history that have used the gracious and graceful way that they dress in a way that speaks volumes diplomatically mm-hmm. and also as representative of our country. Jackie Kennedy is one great example of that and certainly didn't shy away from that at all. But I think in our modern times, we do find it to be, you know, a bit old-fashioned. But we also want our presidential couples to look appropriate.
Yes, exactly. One of the things, again, talking about maybe categorizing or defining, is Laura Bush had an interview very early after mm-hmm. President Bush was elected with Katie Couric.
Right.
And one of the questions that clearly seemed to bother her was that Katie Couric said, "You're a traditional wife. You're a traditional woman." Mm-hmm. And that word traditional seemed to define Laura Bush, and that clearly bothered her as she discussed it in her memoir.
And it was a way to define her, was a way to typecast her. And it was before she even set foot into the White
right.
House. And I think part of that interview, too, was going even further and saying, are you going to be like Hillary Clinton or are you going to be like Barbara Bush? And Laura Bush said, well, I know Laura Bush pretty well. I'm going to be her. And so she was resolute and quick in her response because she knows who she is as a person. But did recognize that that kind of question and the way it was posed and the way it was reported really did help to typecast her for, you know, 8 years. Conveying the word traditional, although that was intended, I think, to be quite negative, there were times along the way in those 8 years where being traditional was actually very helpful. Our travel to Saudi Arabia mm-hmm. in 2007 to launch a breast cancer partnership in a place in the world, in a region of the world, and in a country of the world where certainly it wasn't easy to speak the word breast in public. And, you know, women are covered and talk about, you know, traditional, their role in society is certainly quite different than ours. But Laura Bush, the perception that Laura Bush was a traditional woman there on a health diplomatic mission to improve the lives of women, it was well received. It was well received by the king, King Abdullah at the time, who wanted Mrs. Bush to see the health centers and the diagnostic centers.
So her, quote, traditional mm-hmm. branding mm-hmm. helped her project that message about women's health and breast cancer in a way that perhaps if she weren't branded
right.
that way, it would have been harder.
It would have been harder, and it would have been seen as being critical of the country we're in rather than helping to bring these examples of how we in our own country have changed
right.
and evolved and how, you know, women's health was treated differently even in our country.
So how does a first lady decide what issues she's going to focus on, their priorities? Is that done pre-election, post-election? When is that decided?
I mean, another great question. I mean, it's one, two, that I think every first lady would agree that drawing from their own interests is the best way to start. Then the issues that you choose to work on are authentic mm-hmm. to you, and it's something you have interest that it's conveyed to people you're meeting with, it's conveyed to the public at large, it's conveyed to the world. That's where it's usually best to start, your own interests. In Laura Bush's case, she was a teacher. Literacy and education was important. It was a fundamental platform for all the work that she did.
One of the things that she started, you worked with her on, was the National Book Festival, which
right.
started very, very small.
Correct.
Last year, 250,000 people attended a book festival, which is incredible. Did you ever imagine, or did Mrs. Bush ever imagine it would get this big?
You know, it's interesting because, again, going back to your earlier question, too, how do you choose the things that you work on? For Laura Bush, you know, she had launched the Texas Festival as First Lady of Texas. So she had this model of something that was interesting, that you opened up the Texas Capitol. People came, they listened to their favorite authors, they read books, they brought families. She thought that this might be something that would be interesting on a national level, partnered with the Library of Congress, the Librarian of Congress, James Billington. They were partners for 8 years on this, and it did continue to grow. Authors came, you know, from all over the country. They were hosted at the White House. They were on the National Mall. And every year it got bigger and bigger, even after 9/11. Mm-hmm. Remember, the first book festival was just 3 days before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about 40,000 people, maybe. And then even in the succeeding years and the following year, it was bigger. It was still held. It was still outdoors. You know, we were still reeling as a nation and concerned about major public events outside. But that really was, I think it is definitely a legacy of hers, for
That's
sure.
That's really incredible. So let's go back to categorizing first ladies.
Sure.
Jackie Kennedy brought elegance, mm-hmm. grace, and glamour. Right. Hillary Clinton was the first to really focus on policy issues as a first lady. Do you have your own categorization of first ladies? Do you put them into different buckets? Or how do you think about the roles they've played?
Well, I think each of them have brought their own interests, their own personalities to the position throughout our history. On Mrs. Kennedy, I'm glad that you raised her as an example, because I happen to be on the board of the White House Historical mm-hmm. Association, an association which she founded as a 32-year-old first lady, one of our youngest in history. And although she's known, of course, for her iconic style and her clothing and her graciousness, and she would also want to be remembered for her expansive knowledge of history. And she was incredibly well-versed in history, in preservation. And it's because of her that the White House is able to maintain the museum quality that it has today. That is an incredible legacy of hers to find, to establish a private partner for the White House, to be able to acquire things that belong to the White House, preserve it, restore it. So that is, you know, a very different, you know, view of Jackie Kennedy that it's important that people know. So it's not the one-dimensional view. You know, Mrs. Clinton, of course, she's extremely well-versed in children's issues, family issues, women's issues, and attempted one of the toughest public policy issues anybody can tackle. We're still trying to deal with it in our country, is healthcare. Mm-hmm. And when that didn't work, she did turn her attention to women around the world and left quite an impactful legacy. But every first lady in the modern era really does have Rosalind Carter to thank for the structure of the office that we have and her interest in mental health, that President Carter wanted her to chair the Mental Health Commission, ran up against legal roadblocks to not be able to do that because the spouse of or family member of the president could not hold a formal position. So this honorary chairwoman title was created, and she was quite worried about that, thinking that it would convey cutting ribbons when she knew a lot about this issue. But she was the first to have a policy director, later we would consider a chief of staff. And it was the first time that the personnel rules for the White House included language for the creation of an office of First Lady. However, the staff of the First Lady would be considered staff of the president assigned to the First Lady.
Interesting. Let's do something fun. Let's do a lightning round.
Sure.
All right. Let's come up with one word for you to describe the following First Ladies. You ready?
Yeah.
Michelle Obama.
Focused.
Focused. Okay. Good word. Hillary Clinton.
Determined.
Interesting. Okay. Barbara Bush.
Self-deprecating.
Self-deprecating. She just...
What you see is what you got. I mean, she's very quick to always poke fun. Didn't take herself too seriously, and neither did George H.W. Bush.
Jackie Kennedy.
Graceful.
Graceful. Great word. Okay. Mm-hmm. How about Laura Bush, the one you know best?
I know, and the one I know best, which is the toughest one for me to pick a single word, and so maybe you'll allow me the license of a couple of words. I would start out, number one, with non-judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
She was the most non-judgmental person I ever met.
Interesting.
Even keeled.
Hmm.
Gracious, stoic, and generous.
Well, let's go back to staffing.
Sure.
One of the things that you mentioned in one of your previous speeches, and Ron Kessler mentions in his book about Laura Bush, is that Clay Johnson, who ran the transition, mm-hmm. ran personnel in the Bush White House,
right.
would consult her on personnel appointments. Is that mm-hmm. typical or atypical? And again, who is going to disagree with a first lady on a personnel
right.
matter?
Right. Well, it's a great question. And I think on the things, now remember, Clay also was in the office of the governor, mm-hmm. George W. Bush. He knew Laura Bush's interests there, knew how she was engaged there, knew how George W. Bush and Laura Bush were partners in just about everything, and also knew what areas of interest, what things were important to Mrs. Bush, some of the education programs, the arts agencies, the humanities agencies. And he would seek her advice. Ultimately, though, there was never a question that she may make recommendations mm-hmm. or and she would know about certain people that were being considered. But ultimately, she would tell you, too, these were the president's decisions. Mm-hmm. And she was one of the many people whose good advice would be sought. And it was valuable. The president knew that she was serious. And also, I think what was very important for people like Clay and everybody in the West Wing, they knew at the end of the day, Laura Bush's interests were her husband's. And even in my interview with her in November of 2004 to be her chief of staff, she said that quite clearly. She said, I'm here for George and because of George. Mm-hmm. And what I do, I'd like to, of course, tap into my own interests, but I want it to help him.
So we're in an election year. Mm-hmm. Looking back in history, there have been non-traditional spouses. So Woodrow Wilson's daughter served the role. Andrew Jackson's niece and daughter-in-law served in the role. What are the challenges that non-traditional spouses or non-traditional partners might face in playing the role?
Well, as long as they have the support of the president, they have an opportunity to make a difference mm-hmm. just as if it had been a married spouse.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, as you've mentioned, many examples through our history where a niece, a daughter, someone has had to fulfill, generally has been the social role.
Mm-hmm.
But it also have taken on issues. Like Harriet Lane, President Buchanan's niece, was very well known in Washington for being very engaged in social issues related to women and women and children. So I think that the challenge is, I see it more of an opportunity
mm-hmm.
of helping to evolve this role even further. If someone who is non-traditional, taking on the responsibilities, but using it to the best of their ability, you know, finding their voice, using their platform, which is so unique, in a way that helps push our country or move our country forward, then it's an opportunity, not a challenge.
Let's talk about a few of these individuals.
Sure.
So we're taping this on the Thursday before mm-hmm. the South Carolina primary. And before Super Tuesday. So we have no idea who the Democratic nominee is going to be, and we have no idea whether President Trump will win or lose. So let's talk about a few of the individuals. Dr. Jill Biden, mm-hmm. who's a professor, an English professor, she was the first second lady to actually hold a job.
Right.
Could a first lady hold a job outside of being first lady?
Well, she has helped the country think differently on how someone in these leadership roles in our government can also have a private life. I'm sure it was not without her challenges, balancing the schedule, wanting to travel with your spouse, but also having actual classwork
right.
to do. And she had 8 successful years of doing that. So my sense, if that were to be the case, that she has already found the way to balance it and would continue to do that.
So she could be the first lady
she could
to
be.
Work and to have a full-time or part-time job.
And I think we're heading in that direction at some point.
Okay, let's talk about Michael Bloomberg. So he's
yes.
not married.
Right.
He spends time with a woman named Diana Taylor, who is a very highly accomplished professional, had a number of senior corporate and government roles in New York. There was a big profile of mm-hmm. her the other day. She defines herself as, quote, the person aside from his children who knows Bloomberg the best. So what would be the unique issues that she would face if Mayor Bloomberg were elected president?
Well, if she chooses to move, of course, to the White House with him and actually live in the White House, she would have to make the decision. Does she want to take on those traditional roles that we see come out of the East Wing, which you know the ones I'm talking about, as being the social hostess of the White House? And also, will she want to keep up her professional obligations? There is enough of a structure around the White House where that can work. But I think the decision would be have to be personal. And would a President Bloomberg, if there were to be such a thing, want to utilize any of the other members of his family in a role to fulfill some of these obligations too?
So we have the possibility of the first husband. What would you call a male in the role?
You know, we wrestled with this in 2008, of course, when Hillary Clinton ran for president. And what would we call Bill Clinton? You know, it's a little complicated with him because he was former president. And so, you know, there were other names being batted about. Office of the First Spouse was one of them, seemed to be the one that gathered the most traction.
So Amy Klobuchar, Senator Amy Klobuchar, her husband is a distinguished professor. Senator Warren's husband is also a lawyer and a professor at Harvard. Pete Buttigieg is married. His husband is a teacher.
Right.
So what would be the unique issues that each of them would face?
Again, do they want to continue in their full-time professional roles or take perhaps a temporary departure from that as they are assimilating, you know, into the White House? Again, what I said earlier, no one can completely prepare you for moving into the White House and what comes with that. Now you have this enormous staff around you. I'm talking resident staff that basically are handling all the things you were always handling for yourself. And they're there for a reason. They're there because the responsibilities that fall on the president's shoulders are so monumental and so huge, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so the resident staff is there to make your life easier. And we should want that for our presidents and their families, because for sure, the person who feels the responsibility for the president's well-being the most is the person closest to them, their spouse, for sure.
And do you think the press would scrutinize a first husband, first spouse that's a male differently than a female?
Well, probably wouldn't pay attention to their clothes very much. That'll be one thing that'll change. But will they pay attention to a female, you know, president's clothes? Probably so, to a certain degree. So that might be one thing. It seems minor, but it is what we're used to dealing with. I think the other, you know, changes potentially are, would they want to have their office in the East Wing? Would they actually want to be sitting there? Would they have...
You mean versus having a West Wing or not having an office?
Or not having an office.
Interesting.
You know, and because some first ladies, you know, would work up in the residence. And the office space in the East Wing might be used as meeting space or conference space. So I think that's one question. And I think, too, that what I found really interesting that I what Mrs. Trump did that I think really helped to change the way we look at this role is when she made the decision that she was not going to be moving to the White House right away. And there was all this speculation. Would the president's daughter assume the role? Is she never, or is Mrs. Trump never going to move down here? And she did not buckle to any of that pressure. She just said, I know, you know, who I am. I'm going to take my time thoughtfully selecting a staff. I'm going to take care of my son while he's finishing school up here in this year. People really didn't give her enough credit for at the time is she helped to chip away at the traditional way we look at this role and what we expect a first lady or a spouse to do. And I think it helps all future spouses then also change it up and do it a little bit differently.
And what would you advise one of the male spouses if one of the women or if Pete Buttigieg were to win?
have a good team around you. If that's what you want to do, if you see that as an important role, which it is, because the White House is an important symbol for Americans, and it's an important symbol for people around the world, and it should be maintained, not only that museum quality that we talked about, but as a place where Americans are welcome and people around the world are welcome, and that it's done at a high standard. So whether you choose to do that yourself as the male a spouse, or it's delegated to someone else that the president wants to do it, it should be done well, and you should have an appropriate skilled staff around you to make it happen.
Let me ask you another question. So pushing the boundaries of gender identity.
Right.
So traditionally, the first lady hosts other first spouses, most of whom are women. Occasionally, there are men.
Right.
How would that work if they were a male spouse, and would that be different?
No, I think it would be great. I think, I mean, in our society, we're in the 21st century, or in 2020, men and women work together all the time. And why really should this be any different? This is another one. It's using the White House, again, as another opportunity to help push the envelope a little further.
Right.
What if it were a President Buttigieg's husband as the spouse and in the White House, convening counterparts from around the states and even around the world to work on projects together? My feeling is, you know, it's a platform, whether it's a male or a female that has the privilege and temporary custodianship of that platform. Just use that platform well. Use it to make a difference. Use it to help people. Use it to further your interests. If it helps to further the growth and development and the evolution of our country, then so be it. Use it well.
Well said. Let me ask you one final question, which is looking back at your time and looking back at Laura Bush, what is her biggest legacy in your view?
Yeah. Laura Bush portrayed an incredible sense of calm during a period of time in our history that was like no other. 9/11, of course, was that for Laura Bush. And overnight, you know, the president becomes a wartime president. She becomes a comforter in chief.
Right.
And I think the moniker, it was well-deserved and one that I think people will look back on and realize this was a person, a citizen of our country who at the time that our country was facing its darkest hour, helped to portray a sense of calm for families, for children, for the nation at large, and an appeal to everyone's better angels.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I hope she's remembered that way.
I think she will be, and thanks in part to your good work. Anita McBride, thank you so much for being on the podcast today, and more importantly, thank you for your service to our country.
Oh, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about it.
Thank you. If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.